Okay, TV.
No.
Okay, linoleum knife.
Yes.
What? I don't even know where I'm in. I'm at
a podcast right of the cinema.
Linoleum knife.
Yes.
Not
that one.
Not okay, TV.
No.
Linoleum knife. You said a podcast of the cinema.
That is correct.
I'm Dave White. You're Alonzo Duralde.
That's right.
This podcast is brought to you by nothing this week because I don't feel like making the pitch.
Well, we thank everybody who has already
we
become
do
a
thank
club
you
member.
Who have subscribed.
And if you want to become one,
I'm
great,
not,
but
no,
you know,
I'm
we're not,
not
going to lay
no,
it on
not,
this week.
No, no.
It's obviously been a crappy weekend, and we appreciate everybody who reached out to check in and make sure we were good with the arrest in Los Angeles happening after the horrifying events of Orlando. We're fine. We're good. We're not real happy right now with the state of the world, but
I'm waiting for somebody to try me today, honestly, and anybody.
It's been a it's been a good weekend to block people on Twitter.
Yeah, which I've done.
Yes,
it's funny what you learn about folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'll tell you? Even weirder. It's funny what you learn about gay white men, of which you and I are
yes.
a member of that subset of the queer community. I am, the anti-Muslim people, the anti-Muslim gay white men.
Yeah.
The gun, the pro gun gay white men, you know,
are there?
Oh yeah.
Oh wow.
Oh yeah.
I've not crossed paths with those.
And I'm not talking about gay white men who own guns because that's different.
Sure.
I'm talking about the ones who are arguing against gun control.
Right. Of any kind.
I don't get it. I don't get. Well, it just goes to show that just because you're homosexual doesn't mean you have anything in common with anybody else.
True.
But you know. They just slaughtered 50 of us. So,
well, 49 and the gunman.
Okay. And then like 53 other people were wounded
injured.
And could maybe also possibly die.
Yes.
Where was I going with this? Now you see me too.
Onto the pressing matters of the world. The ones that we're qualified to talk about in public.
I remain not in a good mood. Now you see me too. We do indeed have to discuss this. Is whatever. It's fine. It's grading on the curve. It is a better film than Now You See Me.
I came to a realization while I was watching it. You know, you get the responses to those reviews. Sometimes people are like, oh, you know, you just have to turn off your brain and be entertained.
Right.
And generally speaking, I think that's a ridiculous notion that you can make a movie that is fluffy and all sensation and dopey or whatever and still be intelligently put together. But I would make a case for the Now You See Me movies that they just are best enjoyed if you don't think about anything.
Right.
Because they don't make a lick of sense, but they're so energetic and bright and fun that you just have to kind of go with it. It's like that old... remember that Rosie O'Donnell, back when she used to do stand-up, the routine of like when a six,
like on VH1?
Yes, like on VH1.
Okay.
Like her imitation of a 6-year-old telling a joke.
Right.
And it was just this random string of garbled things, and then suddenly He-Man shows up, and you know, just like just utter nonsense.
David Copperfield, who was one of the producers on this film, would beg to differ with your analysis of it not making sense. Excuse me. He says all the magic in the movie could be done.
Oh, no, the magic is the least of it. I mean, that I just sort of put off as, okay, well, that's their superhero power and whatever. I mean, the things that characters are secretly doing and not telling you until the very last 5 minutes when all is revealed. And right. It does, like, what, huh?
Right.
You know, yeah, it's...
Tell people what it's about.
It's a plot that relies upon just everything falling into place in exactly the right way. All right, so if you may remember in the first movie, we had the Four Horsemen, and we had...
Four Horsemen plus one. You had Mark Ruffalo.
Who was on the DL, who was... Yeah. His father had been a magician, and he was the FBI agent pursuing them, but he was actually their leader. And there is this debunker of magic played by Morgan Freeman, who they wind up framing at the end of the movie and sending off to jail. Although, again, it makes no sense because the Morgan Freeman character is supposed to be sort of a James Randi type debunker of things. But it's not like these magicians claim to have actual magic powers. They just claim to be magicians. I mean...
Right, but
James Randi went after people like, you know, Uri Geller with the spoon bending and stuff.
Right.
You know? Like, no one is debunking Penn and Teller, you know. It's like they're doing a stage act.
That's the part of Morgan Freeman's character that has never been plausible or made sense. Like, you can say you don't believe the magic in this movie could work functionally. But the thing that really doesn't work functionally is the idea that Morgan Freeman could build a career out of walking around telling people, stop enjoying magic.
Yeah, it's all fake.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you.
We knew that.
Duh.
We knew there was a trick. We knew they weren't telling us how they were doing it. I didn't think there really was a rhinoceros in the hat.
Right.
Nothing up my sleeve. Like, I never believed it anyway. I never thought real magic was happening. Like, I knew it was a trick. So this is the weird thing about his character where he's constantly saying, like, it's all a sham.
Don't be fooled.
It's like, well,
duh. Anyway, so since...
I don't think the ladies in Playboy really look like that either. People touching all those photographs when they're done.
So since the first movie, they've been off the grid. And I guess Isla Fisher decided to take a hike because now we have Lizzie Kaplan instead.
Well, she got pregnant.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
She couldn't come back, she got pregnant.
Gotcha. So Lizzie Kaplan plays like the new horse person.
Actually, you know what I think happened? I think she said, oh God, they want me for number two. Here, Sacha Baron Cohen.
Put a baby in me.
Put a baby in me now.
Stat.
Yeah.
But of course, then they all have to come back together for a new big thing because
Daniel Radcliffe needs a chip.
Yes.
He needs a chip that will control every all the computers in the world.
That is such a staple now. Like, going back to the first Charlie's Angels movie, I remember when it was like, oh, you know, it was going to be some device that would have a tracker that would you know, lock into the GPS of every phone on Earth. And I'm like,
right.
Well, doesn't the government have that anyway? And aren't we all just checking in on Foursquare and Yelp and Facebook all the time anyway? So, anyway.
My favorite bit with Daniel Radcliffe is when he says, I dabbled in magic a bit when I was young.
Yes, that was
He can barely contain, he can barely keep himself from winking directly into the camera.
So now they're running around Macau, the Vegas of Asia, as we're told. You know, doing this new thing and you know, hijinks ensue. I have to say, for a movie, if movies are now going to just go to China because everything has to be in China because they're the only ones buying tickets anymore.
You gotta go to China.
This one, at least, had a fairly plausible reason to go to China.
And they got there in a fun way.
They got there in a fun way, and they got fun stuff out of being in China. It wasn't like the Transformers movie where it was just like, oh, okay,
here we are.
Yeah. We need to put Fan Bing Bing in this thing, you know. Right. So, you know, Jay Cho from The Green Hornet pops up briefly, all too briefly, because he was really charming in the Green Hornet, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely idiotic and doesn't make any sense, but I had a lovely time.
I really disliked the first one. I thought it was...
The Jesse Eisenberg's sense of smugness sort of spread through the whole movie.
Yeah, I just thought the first one was very a-hole-ish, just tonally. And
the whole movie was wearing Woody Harrelson's fedora.
Didn't really feel, yes, thank you, exactly that. Didn't feel like Louis Leterrier, is that how you say his name? Director of the Transporter movies.
Or the one and two, anyway.
I don't think he understands the sense of fun you need to bring to a film that is literally empty calories.
Right.
He just wanted there to be a lot of action. John M. Chu, however,
is the king of empty calories.
Understands cartoons. Yes. And that is really what this is. I mean, he's the man behind Jim and the Holograms and a couple step-up movies. My favorite and Bibbs's favorites.
And one of the...
Step Up to the Streets being my favorite.
And one of the
Number three
Furious
being Bibbs' favorite. I think he did one of the Fast and Furiouses, maybe. I'm blanking on that one. You would have to look that up for factual information. But I know that he... Because I don't remember everything he did. Are you doing that right now?
I'm looking it up right now.
Anyway.
Oh, G.I. Joe Retaliation.
G.I. Joe Retaliation. He is... good at making things bounce.
Oh, and the Justin Bieber documentaries.
Yeah. No Fast, No Furious?
Hang on. People are yelling at the...
You're taking too long.
Well, if you would keep talking and vamp a little, I could do this. I can't have all this pressure.
So anyway, I feel like his sense of making these people a team that are... a little bit bickery at each other's throats, sort of insulting each other.
He has not done a fast. There's
a bit of that, you know. Here's the part I don't like. The gay baiting among the men. It irritates me.
But it's not.
I'm done with that stuff. If you put that in your movie and you're not in that world of the Apatow.
Right.
Because that's when it's jovial and it's about something.
Mm-hmm.
It's about.
It's acknowledging the underlying...
Yeah, it's about the panic.
Yeah.
It is not the panic. It's right. About the panic in those comedies. From those folks in that world.
Yeah, you'd think Dave Franco would know better.
If you put this stuff... Well, he's just an actor. If you put this stuff in the movie, you are not probably my friend. Mm. You know what I mean?
You're being that guy.
You're being a turd. So knock it off. There is, having said all this, it's lighter, it's looser, it's more fun. I don't dread part three. If part three is coming, probably might or might not. I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And that, well, they've
announced it.
They've arranged for one, but you don't know. That can just,
sure.
That could get shot down in a second. So... yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's better than the first one. It's still not about anything unless you want to draw some sort of fairly, you know...
tenuous.
Yeah. Line between the plot and the idea of a world in which we are being constantly watched by the government, by, you know, the street cameras everywhere, there's surveillance all around.
Right.
And that is where we live, and that's how the world is now. And so they nod to that a couple times in the film, but they don't make a big show of it.
And that's become almost a trope lately in movies. Either it's about the surveillance state, and it might have something even to say about the surveillance state, or they just rely upon the surveillance state to, like, let the characters know, like, how to follow the, you know, bad guy or whatever,
right.
You know.
So I'm, you know, I'm hesitant to say that it's, that it even has a wisp of...
relevance.
A wisp of meaning.
Yeah.
But they have wisely turned this into a superhero franchise without the superheroes.
Yeah.
Like, kind of douchey Avengers. You know?
Yeah, it's like stage magic is their mutant power, basically.
Yeah.
And they use it to stage heists.
and they want to do it for the Robin Hood purpose of knocking down corrupt,
the man, yeah.
corrupt rich people. And, right. And, you know, yeah, the man.
I mean, it's so flimsily written that Woody Harrelson's character has to be an expert hypnotist.
Yes.
To make people behave in a certain way. Yes. So that other things will then transpire as they should. You know?
Yeah.
Actually, you know who did direct one of the Fast and the Furious movies is James Wan.
Yes.
Who is back in theaters this week with The Conjuring 2.
So long.
Really? You thought?
It's 2 hours and like 15 minutes long.
I know, but it didn't feel it to me.
Oh, but it did.
And I disagree.
Boring.
I disagree.
Not scary.
I disagree.
Laughable.
No. Wow, we saw two different movies here. Clearly.
Here's what happens. First, the Amityville Horror happens.
Right.
And the Warrens, played by
Patrick Wilson.
Vera Farmiga and what's his name?
Patrick Wilson.
Patrick Wilson. They get involved in the Amityville Horror.
Well, that's what they're famous for.
And this version of events maintains that it was not a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was a complete hoax.
The Conjuring is a franchise where the whole based on a true story thing requires a Lot's wife size grain of salt.
Yeah. So the next thing they do, they're so worn out by that.
Okay.
That they decide they don't want to do anymore.
No.
They want to lecture and teach.
It's not just that they're worn out. She has a premonition of his death.
I know, yes. She has a premonition of his death.
From Sister Marilyn Manson.
Exactly. And that,
this creepy...
Don't even get me started.
White-faced like, nun. Ghosty thing.
That thing should have been singing The Dope Show every time it showed up on camera. I thought for a serious chunk of the film that it was Marilyn Manson.
It crossed my mind as
playing
well.
The demon nun.
It crossed
and
my
I
mind
I stayed
as well.
Intentionally through the cast credits. I mean, I stayed through the credits to the end most of the time anyway. But I was scanning that, be like, was that actually Marilyn Manson? So the demon nun phantom is haunting their home.
Mm-hmm.
But along comes the Enfield haunting, which was a thing that happened in the late 70s in London, a suburb of London. And these two young girls found themselves sort of haunted in their rented home with their siblings and their single mom. The Warrens go to England, and it's the late 70s. And the film establishes London as the Londoniest London that ever Londoned.
Yeah, you always complain that it never rains enough in UK movies.
But I'm talking about everything about it. Not just that it was constantly raining, which is appropriate, but that no matter where you go, like The Clash is standing there performing.
Oh, come on. They played London Calling one time as an establishing shot.
So they arrive. And
did you notice the Joanna Lumley poster?
Yeah. Why is there a Joanna Lumley poster on the wall of the kids' bedroom?
Did you see the pictures of the actual kids' bedroom at the end? They had like those David Soul and whatever else.
Did they have a poster of Joanna Lumley?
They might have. She was on the New Avengers.
Oh, she was, wasn't she?
Yes.
Well, it seems unlikely.
No, I bought it.
They have Starsky and Hutch, but yes. I don't know about the rest of it, you know. So at this haunted house, there are approximately two dozen different things happening at any given moment. There are haunted toys. There are big, loud crashing sounds. There are pieces of furniture that throw themselves into walls. There is a rickety Jack Skellington monster that pops out of everywhere. There is an old man ghost in a corner that does nothing but rock in a chair and go ah! Whenever someone gets too close to it. There is the little girl possessed by something that talks like this. There is.
And levitating.
And levitating. There is a TV that won't stop turning on and off. There is a basement ghoul that floods and then sucks people in under the water. And it's. The movie can't decide which thing should be the scariest or which thing should be focused on. So it focuses on everything and actually frightens you with nothing.
Oh, wow.
And
Okay.
until it does this over and over again, which is why I know it got you, and it's the reason it got Gary Cotti, who sat next to me when I saw it. Quiet, 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 quiet. Loud, loud, loud.
Now, I've gotten a lot better at seeing that coming over the
Well, guess who hasn't?
years. Poor Gary.
Yeah. Now, that was my entertainment. Watching him hold his hands over his face, hearing him shriek and literally jump up in his chair. Whitney sat next to Gary and was like looking over at Gary, like, what is going on? Gary, Aaron,
Yeah, oh,
the
yeah.
same thing. They both, neither one of them can stand being like spooked or
Aaron
things
couldn't
thrown at.
take
Yeah.
Aaron got freaked out from the sudden shocks of No Country for Old Men,
Yeah, I know.
which is not like it was, the Prom Night remake or something.
Meanwhile, I'm
Okay.
sitting through this whole thing like this, just stone. There's not
All right.
1 minute of this. There are, I'm going to finish this up and then you can
Okay.
have your defense.
Okay.
There are a couple cool visual moments. Some fun effects every once in a while. And Vera Farmiga
Yeah.
is giving a truly emotional performance in a film that does not give a damn that she's doing
No,
it.
I disagree.
She alone is worth watching in this film. She is making you care about her and her agonizing sort of reticence about this whole enterprise. I don't think Patrick Wilson is doing much. I don't think anything else in the film is worth
You
looking
didn't think
at.
Frances O'Connor as the mother was good?
She's not in it enough. There you
Okay, you're totally wrong.
go. Boring.
First of all, yes, there's all those different things happening in the house, but they're all of a piece. They all felt of a piece of a singular haunting in the way that it's been established in these movies. I agree with you. Vera Farmiga is giving a great performance. James Wan, I don't know that he always gets the credit as a director of actresses in these horror movies, but when you think about like Rose Byrne and Lynn Shay
Yes.
in the Insidious movies, like,
Yes.
I think he really brings this stuff out. I think this movie is scary in a different way than the first Conjuring was. There aren't as many reliances on the jump scares, and it's more about this sort of slowly mounting dread, and I kind of felt it was just this sort of like slowly this slow boil that just kind of kept increasing and increasing and increasing as the movie went along. I was really interested in the whole notion of the Warrens' marriage and their relationship and how
Oh, yeah. Speaking of their marriage and their relationship and their child
Okay, yeah, I
that they
did
have left
I
behind
at Christmas time, I pointed that
at
out in my
Christmas to
review.
go hunt a ghost. Sorry, honey. There is a demon nun living in the other room. Better not go in there. We're leaving. Merry
Yeah,
Christmas.
no.
We'll be back after.
I will give you that one.
There's pizza money on the table.
I'm assuming that the
Everything's
daughter
going to be
I'm
okay.
assuming the daughter
Yeah.
stayed with friends or relatives in a non-haunted house.
You know, 2 seconds of explanation
No,
about
you're right. You're right.
where the kid went.
That is a failing. I grant you that one.
Yeah.
But everything else, I think this movie is genuinely scary. I think it's interestingly put together. I liked the lead female performances. I think Patrick Wilson's a little better than you're giving him credit for, but you're right, he doesn't get tons to do. I also liked that in a haunted house slash exorcism scenario, we kind of know what the steps are going to be. Horrifying unexplained incidents.
Right.
Authorities are brought in and don't know what to do.
Right.
Then like Ghostbusters come in, then this and then this.
Yeah.
At least I think Juan is trying to juggle the steps around and things don't always occur in the sequence that you expect, and there are some like kind of false diversions, and I don't know. I think it's successful. I don't think it's as good as the first one, but I liked it a lot, and I was scared a lot, and I had a good time.
No.
Fine. Yeah, but it's interesting, though, that I was thinking about this, that, like, James Wan and John Chu and Justin Lin are, like, three of our best sort of popcorn directors mm-hmm. right now, and they're all Asian-American filmmakers.
Yep.
If only we, you know... But weirdly enough, with the exception of Justin Lin, none of them have made a whole lot of effort about casting Asian-Americans in their movies.
Well, the Step Up movies
are... That's true. Okay.
...are very sort of multicultural.
Yeah. The casts and Jim, to a certain extent.
Multi-ethnic casting. So, you know, who knows how often they get to say...
True.
You know, ...what they want about
casting. No. I'm not... You know, I'm not blaming them. I'm just pointing
it
out.
It's always weird to me to find out who's got, like, juice and who doesn't.
Right.
And, like, who can just say what they want and get it and who can't.
Mm. Well, you would think the one upside of this whole, again, let's make movies for China thing would be that, like, you know, John Cho would be working all the time.
Right. And he's not.
No.
I mean, he's got jobs.
But... Yeah. Did you see that? There was that Twitter meme.
Yes.
Put John Cho in it or whatever.
Put John Cho in everything.
The other big movie this week is...
Warcraft. Why don't you talk about that?
Oh, brother. Okay. Based on a very popular video game that I've never, ever played.
Well, it's based on the universe in which that video game exists.
Right. Yes. It's not specifically...
Be clear.
Death Realm. Well, I know I'm trying to. It's like, it's funny. Even Matt Atchity, who plays this stuff, kept saying stuff that wasn't like... He said, well, it's based on World of Warcraft. It's like, no, actually, apparently World of Warcraft is like the third iteration, and this is more based on stuff from the first two.
Yeah.
Anyway, blah, blah, blah.
But actually, who cares?
Exactly. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter. It is a massively expensive movie.
Oh, my goodness.
Meant...
It was like a $160 million movie.
Yeah.
And it only made like 30 or something.
Yeah, but it's... Again, it's killing it in China.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yeah. Okay, it like broke box office records in China.
Good for them.
And, you know, it probably works better if you see it in a language you don't speak. So maybe in China they didn't bother to subtitle it or dub it.
No, I'm sure they did. Although you could have it without words and it would be perfectly understandable.
It's a hot mess, this thing. It is this... It's two worlds in this fantasy universe, and one is like big green orcs with tusks and things.
Well, they have jutty out under fangs.
They have under tusks
that are pierced and jeweled.
Like, yes,
you do that to your teeth.
They do apparently.
That would hurt.
Yeah.
And they are called orcs, as you said.
Yes.
And I actually looked up the word
mm-hmm.
orc. Because in my mind, I'm thinking...
Lord of the Rings.
Wait a second. How can you just steal this from Lord of the Rings? But there are actually orcs, not only in the Tolkien stories, but there are orcs in this. There are orcs in, like, two other cultural, you know, things.
Huh.
Another role-playing game has characters called orcs, and I'm blanking on the name of the other role-playing game.
Do they have some mythological...
I don't know. I didn't dig that deep. Okay. I just was like wondering why they get to have orcs.
Yeah.
The lead orc, he could get it.
He was Dr. Doom in the Fantastic Four movie. I forget his name.
That's a cartoon character that I find myself drawn to.
He's no Race Bannon, but all right, whatever. Anyway, so the orcs have some weird sorcery thing, and it is...
You're not going to get the details. You're just going to gloss over this generically.
Basically.
They're in a battle with the humans.
Well, I'm getting there.
Okay.
They have this sorcery that both opens up a portal to the human world and is also destroying their own world. So they open a portal into this human world, And they want to take over. And so, of course, then the humans have to, under King Dominic Cooper and Queen Ruth Naga, both of whom are on Preacher right now, have to send the soldiers out to fight them. And then there's Ben Foster as this kooky wizard gadding about in these, like, you know, prog rock robes and casting spells and stuff. And
his feathered black cape is actually very stunning. And I just, there was just this, he gave off this really great Emerson, Lake, and Palmer kind of vibe that I was very into.
It's the first ridiculous performance I've seen him give, but he is no less committed to the material. I will say that.
I really enjoyed watching him.
The one real performance in the movie, I think, is Ben Schertzer from Pride, who plays like a young rebel mage, who's also casting spells and whatnot. I know some critics have said, oh, this is ridiculous, but I had a good time. I was actively not having a good time for the entire running time of this movie.
I went in under a certain amount of duress. You despised it.
Yeah.
And I have not yet read the reviews from Amy and Manola, Amy Nicholson and Manola Dargis, both of whom, friends whose opinions I really trust.
They've been on the show.
And who've both been on the show before. They wrote positive reviews of this film. And I thought, okay, I can't read these, but now I have to go. Plus, a couple listeners on Twitter got at me and said, you have to go see Warcraft because I have to hear what you say about it. And I hope I'm not disappointing you right now by saying these things about it, but the thing that I want to say about it is that because I went in with zero expectations, by force, pretty much, I did for this film what I do when I have to go see like a Smurf movie. I make sure to go to the Grove because it's closest. I make sure to put on the next level of clothing above pajamas. Like a shirt that is comfy and warm, sweatpants, sneakers, a hoodie. Like, then I go get a donut at Bob's. I'm prepping myself for being 8 at the kiddie matinee.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
I even, for this one, it was a Saturday morning, first screening, like 10:30 or whatever it was. And
you snuck in a bowl of Cocoa Puffs.
Yeah. If I could sneak a bowl of Cocoa Puffs into these things, I would. Although, you know what, there is a way.
Oh, totally.
Just get like a Ziploc bag of cereal.
Or just those little, you know, milk those little individual servings you buy now in the plastic bowl. You just peel the lid off. Sneak in some milk. Yeah, you're in business.
I could totally do that.
But of course, you'd be that guy going,
well, here's what I did.
Let's just let it get soggy.
I bought my ticket. You know, you have to buy your ticket online because everyone's got assigned seating now, which is terrible, a terrible way of doing business for my purposes. And I bought my ticket back in the far back, like I always do. But it kind of filled up. And I thought, people are close. People are near me. I don't like people being near me.
Yeah, I hate that too.
So the minute the movie started, I went all the way down to the front.
Oh.
You know that chunk of the front, most of the houses at the Grove where there's like a walkway, but then there's like 5 more rows of seats?
Yes.
Where nobody sits unless they have to?
Yes, only if the top fills up, right?
Well, no one was down there. So I went down there. That was a good way to watch this movie because I really was, again, like an 8-year-old at the kiddie matinee right down front.
Gotcha.
I did not despise this. It's a bad film. Let's not be mistaking the truth about that. It's a bad film.
It's ugly.
It's not attractive looking at all.
And the orcs look pretty cool until they stand next to humans, and then suddenly they look like just cartoon. They look like Jerry Mouse dancing with Gene Kelly.
Yeah. I thought Paula Patton was hilarious.
Oh, God, with those sad little fangs.
The sad little fangs. But then, you know, they let her fight. She's kind of She-Hulk, you know, battling.
Yeah, green makeup and everything.
And then the big purple box of the whatever that is,
yeah,
of magical magic pops up and just floats around. And then Ben Foster shoots the Pikachu lightning out of his fingers and head. His eyes glow all blue. And then black metal Glenn Close shows up. She looks like a member of Sun.
That was a nice surprise.
I was like, whoa, Glenn Close. All hooded and occult and just soft focused fuzzy. And be like, eh.
That was an afternoon of her life.
Yeah. So I can't say you shouldn't go.
Okay.
You should go under exactly the right circumstances that will allow you to approximate the experience that I had. It is not always a matter of a film being good or even fully watchable. Sometimes it's about external
I don't know that there are enough donuts in the world that could have gotten me through that movie.
Oh, there are.
Because I'll tell you this, in a very short period of time, I had to see this and X-Men Apocalypse and Alice Through the Looking Glass and, you know, a movie that I liked, Captain America Civil War. And so it just, after a while, I was like, oh my God, I want two people in a room with a potato. Like, I want a pixel-free movie.
Have a film about two people in a room with a potato.
I see plenty of that stuff eventually, but just in this concentrated period of time, was like...
That just went on the make me list.
It was, shut up. It was this concentrated period of time.
No, shutting up. That's what's going to happen now. You just accepted your fate.
Okay, you know what? If you're gonna start making this torturous, I can respond in kind.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
What you gonna do?
Oh, you don't want to test me.
What you got?
You don't
want to... I said I wanted someone to try me today. What you got?
I will start digging.
I know you're gonna make me watch. You're gonna make me watch Higher Ground.
Yes.
The first make me. Have we discussed this?
We briefly talked
about it. We decided that in 21 years of being in this
thing called life,
this paradise of love, we've spent 20 years looking at each other exasperated and saying, how is it that you haven't seen this yet? How have I not forced you to sit down and watch this yet? And that's just this ongoing conversation that sometimes gets resolved and most often never gets resolved. Like when I met you, I remember you said, you've never seen Real Genius. This was 1995. Okay.
The movie was only 10 years old then.
I saw Real Genius for the first time in 2015 with you.
Yes.
At a screening.
Right.
At the Arclight.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided for this show, this podcast of the cinema, that we were going to start a new segment called Make Me, where the maker makes the viewer sit down and watch the movie. No refusals. Like, I can't refuse your choice. You cannot refuse my choice. So the first Make Me is going to be you making me watch Higher Ground.
Yes.
Which is a film directed by...
Vera Farmiga. The Conjuring 2.
Yeah. Which I always meant to see when it came out like 2-3 years ago. What was it?
Yeah. 3 or 4 now.
I always meant to watch it. I just never got around to it. And you keep badgering me about it because it's about my...
It's about crazy religious stuff.
It's about my background. Yeah. You're going to watch... Oh, Hussard Baltasar.
You're predictable, Dave White.
I am predictable, but I don't like living in an unbalanced home. And you need to see this film because it's a masterpiece that you need to see. So, what were we doing? Oh yeah, two people and a potato.
Yeah, Warcraft.
Turin Horse is coming your way.
God, I hate you.
Just get ready.
Warcraft. I was definitely burned out on these big sci-fi, you know, flashy, not sci-fi, but, you know, just big flashy CGI loaded epics. And it's an awful one. It is, you know, as Bibbs actually liked this movie to some extent, but as he has said about other movies, if it's not on my worst films of the year list, then it's a really bad year.
Yeah. Yeah, this is not a good movie.
No.
But I had an okay time. Yeah. I just did.
Because you were high on sugar and carbs.
Whatever it takes.
Well, it's like Matt's whole thing now is about like...
If you've got enough candy... Oh, I know what Matt's thing
Matt's,
is.
Matt's for certain movies. Yeah, exactly. Like, how
he
many
and Christy show up and they're like, are y'all already buzzed?
They're like, I gotta have some cocktails before this movie.
He and Christy have developed a... Have they've got a pact.
Oh, yeah. They talk now, about this on the show.
They're like, how many drinks? They showed up for Conjuring 2 and I was like, are you guys buzzed already? Is this already happening? Anyway, so...
And then I saw two movies that you did not, which I'll zip through quickishly. De Palma is great, 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 and you should totally go see it if it's showing near you.
I haven't seen it yet.
A24 picked it up. You, Dave White, need to see it.
I will.
It is a documentary about the life and work of director Brian De Palma, and he basically is the one... speaker. It's not a thing where they interviewed everybody he ever worked with and edited it all together. They keep cutting back to the same static shot of him in a chair telling his life story and talking about his work. But they directors Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow, interweave the movies he's talking about, movies he made. It is so exciting to watch and so fascinating to hear this guy. And I'm not a giant De Palma fan. Like, I know friends who, you know, like... never stop talking about Dress to Kill or, you know, Carrie or Phantom of the Paradise or whatever. I like De Palma. I love some of his movies. I am not a fan of other ones. But he's so interesting, and he has such interesting things to say about not just his own work, but how Hollywood works and how, you know, what his influences were and that whole crazy period of the 70s with, you know, him and Lucas and Coppola and Spielberg and Scorsese, you know, and the kind of the studio Young Turk types, you know. I would love Baumbach and Paltrow to, like, make this same movie with all those other guys. Yeah. Just have them sit down and talk about everything and you know, acknowledge things they did wrong and explain what they were thinking. You know, for instance, when De Palma talks about Bonfire of the Vanities.
Right.
He said that movie should have been along the lines of The Magnificent Ambersons and Sweet Smell of Success.
Yes.
At the same time, he pragmatically realizes that those two movies pretty much ruined the careers of Orson Welles and Sandy McKendrick.
Okay.
So he opted to chicken out and cast Tom Hanks and try and make him more likable and try and have he didn't want to make it as dark as it should have been.
Oh,
because
see.
Audiences would have been turned off by that. And turns out they were turned off by it anyway.
Got it.
And he even has nice things to say about Julie Solomon, who wrote The Devil's Candy, which is this great behind-the-scenes look of the writing of the making of Bonfire, if you've never read it.
Right.
And he basically acknowledges that, yeah, it's all true. Like, she didn't get anything wrong. She didn't make anything up, you know.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, extraordinary movie. Whatever your feelings are about Brian De Palma, I cannot recommend it enough. It's really great. I also saw Genius, which is terrible.
It made something like $400 this weekend.
Per screen?
I just looked at that on Box Office Mojo. I don't know if that was per screen or total, but it's way down at the bottom of the list.
It's, oh, God. Okay, remember those movies when they would wheel...
I don't know who's in it. I don't know who made it. I don't know anything about it.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Remember when they would wheel the 16mm projector into our classrooms and we were, you know, grammar school and middle school?
Yes.
And it would be some film about the life of, like, George Washington or, you know, some painter or writer or whatever.
They were always awful.
Yeah. This is about that level.
Oh, good.
It's about the relationship between editor Maxwell Perkins, who is played by Jude Law. No, sorry. Who's played by Colin Firth, and Thomas Wolfe, who's played by Jude Law.
Okay.
It's funny. I was just watching Preacher and Dominic Cooper and Ruth Negar having a scene together, and you just looked up and said, are these both British people playing Americans?
Yes.
This is a movie about American literary giants who are all played by British people or Australians, because we have their brief appearances by Maxwell Perkins' other big discoveries, which were Ernest Hemingway is played by Dominic West and F. Scott Fitzgerald is played by Guy Pearce.
Okay.
You know how movies about writers tend to be terrible because writing is like the least cinematic thing possible?
So, sitting.
Yeah.
Typing.
I've done it! This is a movie about an editor. And there is...
That's very exciting.
I will give them credit. There's one sequence where they actually sort of illustrate how editing works. When Wolf brings in his first draft of The Time in the River after Look Homeward, Angel's been a hit, it's something like five crates of wrapped up papers that getting brought into Perkins's office.
Yeah.
So Perkins goes after this one sequence that's about where a guy sees a woman at a party and is immediately like, you know, falls in love with her.
Okay.
And Perkins reads Wolf's original draft of it. It goes on for pages and pages and pages. It has this really clever use of, like, adjectives and, you know, this and that and the other thing. And he's just like, well, this should be about... Falling in love is like being struck by lightning. You can't be struck by lightning for four pages.
Right.
And he just, like, makes him cut and cut and cut. And they basically bring this whole giant mass of prose down to about three sentences. And it's like, ah, okay, that's... Bravo movie. That's a sequence that shows how editing works, you know. And this is based on A. Scott Berg's acclaimed biography of Max Perkins, which is, I hear, very good and totally worth reading. But this movie is just like all the sort of great man of letters cliches bound together.
And it's a period film.
It's period.
Are the period details worth looking at?
You know, they're nice.
Will I like looking at that in that world?
It is not like Downton Abbey period details.
Oh.
I mean, it's not aggressively shabby either, but it's the 30s, and it's the 30s among people who aren't super rich,
right.
So it's just kind of functional.
Got it.
It's well done, but you're not going to want to go to see the sconces, is what I'm saying.
You know, I love a sconce.
I know you do. Jude Law, his accent is so dipped in honey that they should just serve it with a biscuit. And Colin Firth is kind of...
I'll take one biscuit with Jude Law on it, please.
Colin Firth is just sort of blankly mid-Atlantic. He has one kind of moving scene at the end that is dialogue-free. Nicole Kidman plays...
She's
Thomas Wolfe's married mistress.
Okay.
And Laura Linney plays Perkins' wife.
Oh, so this has a cast.
Oh, yeah. But first-time filmmaker, I think he's like a theater guy or something. It's written by, the one who's not John August. The guy who wrote Gladiator and who does Penny Dreadful.
I'm blank.
John Logan.
Okay.
John Logan.
All right.
It's not good. I went to see it to review it, and it just at the end of it, I was like, this is such a nothing movie. Like, I'm just not even going to bother. And you're right. Nobody went to see it. Nobody cares. It's somebody read that Perkins biography and thought, oh, wow, he's amazing. And look at all these amazing, these interesting people he had in his life. And then they just make this movie that sucks
Here they all are.
Yeah.
Look at them.
Exactly. Look, we've recreated the Scribner's and Son office, everybody. You know, it's just nothing.
I don't have a DVD pick.
Oh, you know, I hadn't thought about it. Let's see what opened the.
I got nothing.
You're
just pulling something out of the top of your head.
I'm pulling something out of the top of my head.
I don't have anything. I started watching In the Good Old Summertime on TCM.
Oh, brother!
Yesterday, because I'm, you know, it's my Judy Garland completion project,
right?
Oh, sometimes there are films where Judy singing is the only reason you want to even put eyes on this thing. She's always the reason. And even if the movie is boring as hell, like In the Good Old Summertime,
for instance,
when she's singing,
yeah,
she's got you.
Totally.
She's got you right by the everything.
My DVD pick is Hitchcock Truffaut, because of De Palma. It's a movie about the legendary interview between Alfred Hitchcock and François Truffaut that led to the book of the same name. And there's a lot more photography and audio and stuff of that interview in existence than I knew. So it has a lot of that. It has a lot of sort of contemporary people talking about why it was important and who, what they each brought to the table in those conversations. And, you know, if you're a film buff, you'll have fun with that.
I'm not saying you should watch In the Good Old Summertime.
No,
it is
not
my DVD recommendation.
I will not put it as such, not to worry.
It's, you know, you need to be a completist like I'm being for this particular artist.
So. Do you want to recommend one of the good Duncan Jones movies, perhaps?
Moon.
Okay, perfect. Because boy, Warcraft.
We don't need to talk anymore about Warcraft.
But still, you can tell that he is he. You remember the original ads for Office Space where it was that guy covered in Post-its?
Yeah,
that's how I picture Duncan Jones directing this movie, with
Post-its.
Covered in studio notes.
Had a suit made of Post-its. Yeah, that he just wore to the set one day.
Could barely move.
Here I am, everybody. Just write on me.
Tell me what to do.
One letter.
Okay.
Well, it's a message, really. From Clint. Thank you for getting Linoleum Knife on Google Play. Did we make that happen?
I did that with the help of Andy, yes.
I see. Essentially, it is Google's version of iTunes. You can buy and stream music on it, movies, and now podcasts. I am on a basic T-Mobile plan, but I can stream Google Play without using my data.
Oh, well, all right then.
So this helps someone.
Yes.
And that's good.
Hooray.
Hang on. I'll just do, I just lost it. The end.
Fine.
End of letters.
Thank you for listening. Listen to the people we always tell you to listen to. You know who they are. There is a new Let's Gay up on on YouTube from our friend Johnny Jungle Guts. The Comics Canon has been doing some interesting stuff of late. From our friend Kurt Holman, their new episode is all about Darwin Cook's The New Frontier. And Cook, of course, passed away recently after a battle with cancer. But listen to Bibbs and Whitney. I think my episode of Cancel Too Soon might be popping up soon. Of course, they're also on the B-Movies podcast. And thank you, Blue, for our theme music. And, you know, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast.
And things.
Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will be coming up with our new, our latest Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode in the next couple of weeks for Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps.
Yep.
And if you want to join us for our next Linoleum Knife viewing party next weekend...
is it this coming Saturday?
Not this coming Saturday, but a week from Saturday.
The 25th.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll be doing Satoshi Kon's Millennium Actress, which is currently streaming for free on YouTube. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife for more information about that. And we will be in a better mood next time, we promise.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Goodbye.